And thank you for inviting me to do this. I'm really excited to do it. It's always a little bit of an odd experience for me doing these kinds of webinars because I can't see anybody's reactions, and so I have no idea whether you all are looking at me with confused eyes or laughing when I'm making jokes or anything else. But I'm going to assume that everything is going swimmingly until I get questions in that say that I need to clarify something, and then we'll have time at the end to talk some more as well. So as Andrea so nicely said, I'm just going to try to give you an overview of some of the research I've been doing over the last number of years, focusing specifically on treating PTSD in people with borderline personality disorder. So I'm going to start by, however, giving you kind of a high-level discussion here of why the treatment, why I thought something was needed. Andrea already alluded to this. But so my thinking on this and in general with treatment development is there's no need to develop treatments when good ones already exist for the problems you're trying to treat. So the first thing we wanted to sort of establish was, you know, whether this was, in fact, a novel problem that did not yet have an effective treatment option for it. So I'm going to have to sort of walk you through the slides verbally a little bit too, but on that first slide, the problem, as you all I'm sure know already, many individuals with borderline personality disorder have histories of trauma and often quite extensive trauma, pretty commonly starting in childhood and continuing through adulthood. And approximately half of people with BPD meet full diagnostic criteria for PTSD. So, a point to make there, too, is not everybody, of course, has PTSD with borderline personality disorder, but quite a big chunk do. We also know that suicide and self-injury are very common among people with BPD. It's obviously one of the diagnostic criteria, but up to 80%. Self-injure and or attempt suicide, and it's got one of the highest mortality rates of any psychiatric disorder, with 8 to 10% dying by suicide. We also know that having PTSD comorbid with BPD reduces the likelihood of achieving remission from borderline personality disorder, and this is over 6 and 10 years of follow-up from Mary Zanarini's research showing that people with PTSD were less likely to get to diagnostic remission in BPD over time. And then there's some newer research also that's come out from some folks in the UK showing that having PTSD predicts worse outcome during dialectical behavior therapy as well. So the people with PTSD ended up having more self-injury throughout their year of DBT than the people who didn't have PTSD. So it looks like it's interfering with recovery from BPD or remission from BPD as well as treatment response if you have that co-occurring diagnosis. And one of the reasons for that, presumably, is that PTSD does increase the risk for both self-injury and suicidal behavior in borderline personality disorder. About doubles the rate of self-injury, for example, among people with BPD. So there's a lot of overlapping issues here. But with these three problems really commonly co-occurring with PTSD, really exacerbating and worsening some of the problems, some of the core problems with BPD. So that is sort of the high-level picture of why we thought we needed something that would, a treatment that would address all three of these problems, because doing one in isolation is unlikely to be as effective as we would like. So the state of the treatment world, however, was that if you had borderline personality disorder, particularly if you were suicidal and self-injuring, you would be sent off in one direction to get treatment. And if you had PTSD without any of those other problems, you would be sent in a different direction to go get treatment. And these things were very separated. So if you come at this from the angle of PTSD treatments, the question was, are there PTSD treatments out there that work for more severe borderline clients? And the the issue with the PTSD treatment research literature is that the kinds of clients we were trying to treat are excluded from PTSD treatment and studies of those treatments. So overall, about 30% of patients who are referred for PTSD treatments in clinical trials are excluded. And the more exclusion criteria that researchers used in their studies, the better outcomes they got. And then the most common exclusion criteria were suicide risk and substance use disorders, and then the sort of this catch-all serious comorbidity. But with that combination of exclusion criteria, it's quite likely that anybody who has severe, more severe borderline personality disorder is unlikely to be eligible for PTSD treatments. And then coming at it from the angle of BPD treatments, the next slide, as far as I know, there's no study looking at the effect of other BPD treatments on PTSD, so like mentalization-based therapy. I don't know of any research on any treatment aside from DBT in terms of what kind of impact they're having on PTSD. So what we know from DBT, if you look at this bar graph, is that DBT in general is actually quite effective at treating co-occurring Axis 1 disorders. So this shows the rates of remission from a number of co-occurring Axis 1 disorders. This is during 1 year of DBT and then 1 year of follow-up. And these were all women with borderline personality disorder who were suicidal or self-injuring at intake. So the point to make here, you see the box around the PTSD, that PTSD is the least likely to remit of any Axis 1 disorder during DBT, so 35% remission rate compared to, you see, the highest is substance dependence, 87% get to remission with that diagnosis. So when I looked at this data and, you know, this paper came out and all that in 2008, we sort of felt stronger that, yes, we know something needs to be different here. We need to figure out a way to be more effective during DBT in treating PTSD, particularly because it's so common and it can be so incapacitating. So, you know, there's any number of reasons why this remission rate may be lower than we would like. And the main issue here, our thinking, is that in general, PTSD has not typically been targeted during DBT. So if you're not trying to treat it, it's unlikely to remit. And I think there's a number of reasons why it hasn't been targeted, including a lack of clarity in the DBT manual, for example, about exactly when you could start treating PTSD and then how you would treat PTSD once you know, you got to that stage 2 point where PTSD is most often considered the, you know, when you're going to be targeting it. So I think there was not a lot of information about how to do it and when to do it, and then there was a lot of sort of warnings in there about, like, be super incredibly careful when you do consider doing this, because if you do it at the wrong time, you know, all hell could break loose, essentially. So I think there were good reasons people haven't been targeting it during DBT, and so we also wanted to try to clarify, you know, figure out what some of these things could be in terms of when and how to do it so that people would feel more able to do it. So that is sort of to say that prior to doing this, that there was no existing treatment either from the PTSD side of things or the BPD side of things that was working for this population of clients as much as we would have liked it to. So the treatment development process, what I'm going to do is kind of walk you through what we did as we were trying to develop this treatment and some of the problems that we encountered and some of the solutions we came up with. I could talk about this for days and days, so these are sort of some of the higher level things. But just to give you a sense of kind of where we are and how this process went. In general, what the DBT text does say about treating PTSD, it gives you two options. It says, one, either use the exposure procedures that are already a core problem-solving strategy in DBT and use them in a really focused way, or take an existing exposure-based PTSD treatment and integrate it into DBT. So I opted to do that second approach, which was to take an existing exposure treatment, so specifically prolonged exposure therapy for PTSD, which is Edna Foa's treatment, and figure out how to integrate it into DBT and modify it only when we really felt like it was needed. So we tried to stick as close as we could to prolonged exposure as it is written up in Edna Foa's manual, and make as few changes as possible while we figured out how to weave it into DBT. So in general, we have had 1 year of standard DBT, outpatient, all the regular modes of DBT, and then this DBT prolonged exposure protocol is what we're calling it, is done concurrently with standard DBT sometime during that treatment year, and I'll talk more about that, and it's always been done by the individual DBT therapist. So as we launched into doing this, we had picked our general treatment approach that we were going to use. The first problem to solve was the first problem that we would all imagine would need to be solved, is that I agree that people who are at high risk for suicide and self-injuring and all that kind of stuff are not good candidates for starting PTSD treatment. So, a lot of our clients had a lot of higher priority problems that made targeting PTSD not a tenable thing to do. And similarly, they had, limited capacity to tolerate distress or experience emotions, both of which are going to be a necessary ingredient of doing an exposure-based treatment. So if they didn't have those skills up front, then exposure therapy in general was also not going to be tenable to implement right away. So what we've done is used a stage-based, or some people say phase-based, approach to treatment. So everybody gets 1 year of standard DBT. The beginning is sort of what we think of as stage one DBT, where we're really focused on behavioral control, trying to get these higher priority behaviors, self-injury and suicidal behavior and all of that, under control, and getting them skills, teaching them the skills that they need in general, but also the skills they're likely to need specifically to get through exposure-based treatment for PTSD. And then at whichever point we decide that together that they are ready, which I'll say more about, to start PTSD treatment, then we add in the DBT-PE protocol, but it's concurrent, so everybody's still doing all four modes of standard DBT, and the focus of the DBT-PE protocol is really on emotionally processing trauma. The way that we've done that just concretely is two ways. One, we've either done it in one individual therapy session per week that's a two-hour session, where 90 minutes of it is focused on the DBT-PE, and then 30 minutes is standard DBT individual therapy. Or we've split it into two separate individual therapy sessions per week, one which is 90 minutes just to do the DBT-PE work, and then a separate one that is a full hour to do regular individual DBT therapy. So those are the two general approaches while we're doing that treatment. And then if we've timed it right and, we have time left in our year of treatment, then we move on after that to building a life without PTSD, sort of whatever targets are remaining at that point, which are often things related to building relationships, potentially ending relationships that they're now seeing as being unhealthy, getting back to work and school, sort of really connecting with the community and the world. And these stages map on very nicely to Judith Herman's stages of trauma recovery, if folks are familiar with that model, as well as sort of the current recommendations for the stages of treatment to go through if you're treating complex PTSD, are all very similar here. And just to say, too, that the 1 year of standard DBT is a bit artificial. We had to have a specific time frame because it was in a research setting, but it doesn't have to, end at exactly a year if you have the luxury of going longer than that. So that's the general approach. So we're really trying to get people through stage one DBT first so that we can get them to the point where we can treat their PTSD. And another thing that we have come up with along the way to make that more possible, because, you know, the concern we all had was, well, what if we can't get them stabilized enough during the year for that to actually work? Is we've figured out some strategies for using the contingency management and commitment strategies within DBT to increase people's motivation, not only to treat their PTSD in the first place, although, frankly, that's not usually a tough sell for most people who have suffered from PTSD for, you know, many, many, many years. Usually if you say to them, would you prefer, you know, not to have PTSD than to have PTSD, almost everybody that I've ever met is going to say yes to that question. So typically people are, you know, at least somewhat interested in the idea of treating PTSD. Usually they are not super excited about the idea of exposure therapy for PTSD. But at the same time, they are willing to try it because they think it could work for them, a lot of them, which I'll say some more about some of our specific data on that. But the contingency management thing that I want to highlight is, you know, when you start treatment with somebody who is suicidal and self-injuring and has a lot of other problems that we're thinking will have to go away in order for us to be able to treat their PTSD, for people who really are wanting to treat their PTSD, we have found that it is often incredibly motivating for them, for us to say essentially, you know, that we would love to treat their PTSD and we know how to do that and we think it would really work for them, you know, and we think it would make a huge difference in their lives in general. And we are completely unwilling to do that as long as they are still self-injuring, as long as they are still trying to kill themselves, as long as, you know, any, you know, other behaviors which we think are really higher priority are going on, that we aren't willing to treat their PTSD. And saying it like that and sort of laying out that contingency really early in treatment, in the pre-treatment phase of DBT, has been really effective in getting a lot of our clients to feel even more motivated to stop self-injuring, stop trying to kill themselves, all that kind of stuff, in order to be able to treat their PTSD. So essentially, PTSD treatment becomes a reinforcer for getting behaviors under control, which, you know, was a bit of a surprise in some ways that actually PTSD treatment would be a reinforcer as opposed to it perhaps being scary enough that people would, you know, not want to stop those behaviors so they wouldn't have to ever deal with their PTSD. But really, that has been our experience for the majority of clients, is that if we lay out clearly what the sort of rules are here at the beginning, that helps them be even more motivated and get ready to treat their PTSD faster. So the next problem that we came up against was, you know, so we, like I said before, the DBT text doesn't say very clearly, like, when would we know that somebody is actually ready to start their PTSD treatment? So we, you know, went through a process of coming up with different readiness criteria and then testing them out during our treatment development process. And essentially what we were looking for here was, you know, what criteria were we using that seemed to be working to kind of differentiate the people who were able to then get through the PTSD treatment, particularly without a relapse of self-injury or suicidal behavior during that part of the treatment. Is really kind of what we were looking for, is we wanted a set of criteria that really seemed to be distinguishing people who were then stable enough to do the treatment without going back into stage one behaviors, essentially. And so the criteria that we have on this slide, deciding when to start PTSD treatment, I'll walk you through these, kind of where we have landed during this process. So the first one is not, you know, they have to not be at imminent risk of suicide. And, you know, that means kind of the common things we think of clinically. So, you know, they can't have an intent to kill themselves soon, you know, like in the next couple of weeks, with, you know, high suicide ideation and a plan and all that kind of stuff. It's essentially things that we think make them likely to actually, try to kill themselves very soon. And so, you know, this isn't the person who says things like, if this treatment doesn't work, then I'll kill myself after that. Not that kind of thing, but really somebody that we think, you know, in the next couple of weeks to a month, we think could actually be dead because they're just really seriously still thinking about suicide, perhaps even planning, and not committed to staying alive fully and that kind of stuff. So let me just say quickly, too, that most of these criteria, as you can probably see, these are not going to be incredibly clear-cut things that we can have a clear, marker for. This is all going to be clinical judgment as well. So this first one for sure is in sort of deciding whether we think somebody is at imminent risk or not. But those are the kinds of things that we think through. The second one, this is going to be our most clear-cut one, and the one that took us the longest to decide on. But where we've landed is that we require at least 2 months of total abstinence from any form of life-threatening behavior. And life-threatening behavior, this is the DBT term for life, what I'm referring to. So it includes all forms of non-suicidal self-injury as well as any suicidal behavior. All of that has to be stopped for at least 2 months. And, some of the things that we thought through as and we tried out when we were figuring out what to do. We started with this one at the past 4 months, so we needed 4 months of abstinence, and then we whittled it down to 2 months based on the fact that people weren't relapsing into those behaviors. And so 2 months is kind of where we're at, which doesn't mean you have to launch in exactly at 2 months, but we look for at least that period of time. Another thing that we were considering was whether to allow some forms of, for example, non-suicidal self-injury to be ongoing, like really low-risk kinds of behaviors, like hitting yourself in the legs and things like that. And we ended up doing the treatment once with somebody who was still actively self-injuring in that way, and a second time with somebody who we didn't know was, but ended up telling us, that she had been after we started. So, what happened with both of those cases, again, a small sample, but their self-injury got worse. It became more frequent and sometimes more severe. So in my mind, I think of this in two ways is why we have this kind of really hard and fast rule of total abstinence. One is that it's really effective as a contingency management strategy, again, where if you say to a client, well, you just need to stop trying to kill yourself or, more severe self-injury, but you can keep doing the low-risk self-injury and that would be okay, then they're going to keep doing the low-risk self-injury, chances are. Whereas if we have this hard no behavior at all, then people will stop all of it. And then secondly, for that people who are still actively self-injuring in any way, it seems like it essentially means that they still don't quite have the emotion regulation or distress tolerance skills that we need them to have if they're still relying on that behavior to manage emotions, essentially. So for those two reasons, we have kept this a really hard and fast rule of absolutely no self-injury of any type or suicidal behavior. So the third one on here, ability to control life-threatening behaviors in the presence of cues for those behaviors, that was put in there simply because we wanted to make sure that people didn't get to that point of 2 months of abstinence by somehow managing to avoid everything in their lives that makes them want to self-injure or makes them want to kill themselves, because I'm quite sure that, for most people, doing trauma-focused treatment is going to put them into contact with some emotions and cues and memories that historically have made them want to self-injure or made them want to try to kill themselves. So we wanted to make sure that they actually had gotten to abstinence while having urges, being in the presence of cues, and being able to effectively manage their urges and not engage in those behaviors. So we may set up behavioral tests for people, for example, if we think that there might be quite a lot of avoidance going on that's helped them to get under control. So, for example, a person who, if they only usually self-injure after a phone call or an interaction with some ex partner in their lives or something, and you know they avoid contact with that person completely for a period of time so that they don't self-injure, but that's a person they actually do need to have contact with, say they have shared custody of kids or something like that, then you know we'd set up a test and say, like, I need you to have a phone call with this person or interact with this person and show us that you can actually get through that without self-injuring, for example. So that's what that third one is for, is just in case this has been achieved through avoidance, essentially. No serious therapy interfering behavior. This is going right down the DBT target hierarchy, and this is really essentially the person is essentially not engaged in treatment. That's the level of seriousness that we're thinking of here. They hardly ever show up, or they you know, never do their homework of any sort. You know, they're not very collaborative in sessions ever, that kind of stuff. It's so we routinely start doing this treatment with people who sometimes don't come and sometimes don't do their diary cards and sometimes get angry at us during sessions and all that kind of stuff. It's you know, really to the point here, like there's no reason to try to do PTSD treatment because the person's not even in treatment enough for any treatment to work, essentially. After that, we are in the quality of life domain in DBT, and at that point, it's up to the client what they want to target. So this is then their decision. Is PTSD their highest priority target, and do they want to do it now? And then the final one is that we want also some evidence that they are now able and willing to experience intense emotions without escaping. And this is escaping in ways that may be more dysfunctional, like substance use or dissociation or whatever, as well as, you know, escaping in ways that are functional that we've now taught them how to do with DBT distress tolerance skills, for example. We want to know that they can just sit with an emotion and not do anything to try to make it go away or to try to change it and just allow it to happen. And so those are skills we teach in DBT as well, and typically we get evidence of that just from our regular therapy sessions with clients. But if we aren't getting that evidence, then we might also set up tests for that to try to see, you know, if they are able to do that, tell us a really sad story about something that happened, not a trauma, but a sad story, and show us if, you know, you can sort of sit with the sadness that comes up, for example. So those are the criteria that we are using about deciding when somebody is ready to start. So after that,
Melanie, just to clarify, does substance use play a role in your readiness criteria?
Yeah, so substance use can show up either as a serious therapy interfering behavior. If a person is coming to your sessions while drunk or high on something, that would be a therapy interfering behavior that would make it not worth trying to do PTSD treatment because it won't work if they can't come to your sessions sober. So that's mostly where that would show up, and then also for the client getting to decide if they want to target that before their PTSD. The rule that we have about substance use is we have done this treatment any number of times with people who are still actively using substances. What we ask for is a commitment to come to all sessions totally sober. We ask for a commitment to do all of their exposure homework, of which there's quite a lot, between sessions, to do all their exposure homework totally sober. And then a little bit randomly, we also ask for a two-hour window of time after any exposure task they do, that they don't drink or use drugs for at least 2 hours afterwards. So we're trying to get them, you know, from having the experience of getting through an exposure task only because then they can, you know, right away go and have a drink afterwards is the only reason they, you know, got through it, they would think, or something. So we're just trying to get a delay from completing exposure to any substance use as well. But that's what we've asked for, and that has worked fine with the people that we have done this with who are actively substance using. When we're getting started. Typically what happens is their PTSD starts to improve and then their need to use substances or their urges to use substances go down as well because often they're using them to self-medicate their PTSD symptoms. So that's substance use. Okay, so the next problem was that the clients might have satisfied our readiness criteria, and then sometimes the therapists were still afraid to move forward or unwilling to move forward in treating the PTSD. And so this is where our NDBT, our consultation team, was really helpful in trying to assess and problem solve any therapist factors that might be interfering. Often it was sort of fear of making the client worse, or just not being certain about whether the client was really ready or not, or not being confident in their own ability to treat PTSD, things like that. So those are all things that we would deal with on our consult team. And one of the things we have been doing on our team now is we actually have like a tracking sheet of all those readiness criteria that we were using with each client on it, and that just became sort of part of our weekly meeting, was to check in on which clients, you know, were, you know, had achieved different criteria or not, like how close people were to being ready, to kind of keep that front and center as something we were all thinking through and talking through on team as well. So consultation team to help with therapist issues. The next issue was, for those of you familiar with prolonged exposure therapy, it doesn't include any methods for kind of for monitoring suicide risk or any other kinds of negative reactions that might show up as a result of exposure. So we wanted to make sure that we knew what was going on, you know, the suicide and self-injury urges and things like that for our clients, just in case they were going up as a result of doing exposure. So we added in, you know, DBT self-monitoring strategies. Everybody's still doing their DBT diary card. As usual, we review that at the beginning of every session, even if it's a DBT PE session, just to make sure there's not a behavior that showed up on there that would make us not want to do this treatment today. But then we also have a form we use when they're doing their exposure tasks that asks them before and after every exposure task to rate their urges, a number of things, suicide, self-injury, substance use, all this kind of stuff, so that we have a read on whether they've suddenly jumped up or not as we're doing the exposure, so that we can intervene if we need to with DBT. So that was something we added in, was the self-monitoring. The next problem is that once we got into actually doing exposure, you know, a fair number of our clients had difficulty getting effectively emotionally engaged during the exposure itself. So emotional engagement is just sort of the how much you're able to have emotions and have them in a range of intensity that's, you know, sort of somewhere in this middle range. It's a pretty wide range, but the things we get worried about is when people's emotions are either too low on the spectrum, so people have kind of shut down their emotions, are suppressing emotions, are avoiding in some way, and so they're not getting very emotionally engaged, or the other end, so the over-engaged end, where they're really, really, really high in terms of their emotional intensity, to the point where, you know, they're not able to take in information or learn the information that we need them to learn during exposure. So, you know, in our clients, the most common thing that happens if that goes to that end of sort of over-engagement is people dissociate. Their emotions get super, super intense, and then they dissociate, at which point, you know, there's nothing new, no new information coming in. Exposure is not going to work. So we've ended up, as needed, not all clients need this, but as needed, adding in DBT skills that people can use during the exposure itself, either if their emotions are super intense to the point where we think they're over-engaged, to get those emotions down-regulated some. These are essentially the distress tolerance skills, the crisis survival skills specifically in DBT, as well as opposite action we also have people use. So, for example, if they're having super intense shame, we'll have them do opposite action during the exposure, so sitting up straight and speaking confidently and looking at the therapist and this kind of thing to get their shame to come down. On the other side, so just to say, too, the over-engagement is what everybody worries about is going to happen. That's actually not incredibly common, and the much more common problem is the other end is people are under-engaged. They're just, you know, emotions are shut off in some way. And so with that, we use basically the DBT mindfulness skills and radical acceptance skills during exposure to try to upregulate emotions, to get them to allow emotions to be there more intensely and really stay focused and accepting and willing and all that kind of stuff to have emotions. So essentially sort of using DBT skills as needed to really facilitate the exposure. Okay, so the next problem is that clients with BPD often have multiple problems and chaotic lives, which generally makes focusing only on one problem hard to do. So this is, you know, why we have kept it concurrent with standard DBT, meaning that they're still getting skills group, they're still getting some amount of individual DBT therapy while they're doing the DBT PE work, so that we can use DBT and everything that comes with it to address any other serious problems that may show up during the treatment, whether or not they're related to the PTSD treatment, because they're not always related to the PTSD treatment, but we're using DBT to address any other problems that may be going on. And using it in a way where we're hopefully trying to get them, you know, able to go through the DBT PE without having to stop it, where we have another time and a place and strategies to address things that would be going on that may show up, but without having to stop the PTSD treatment as well. So that being said, we did also end up having to come up with criteria or guidelines for when we do need to stop the PTSD treatment. And this is not because they're better and their PTSD is gone, but because something has come up that makes us feel like it's not appropriate to continue right now. So we do also have specific guidelines for when to stop if higher priority behaviors occur. We also have a zero tolerance policy essentially on all forms of self-injury and suicidal behavior. So if any of that happens during the DBT-PE part of the treatment, we will stop the PTSD treatment until the behaviors are under control again and they've sort of satisfied various criteria like made repairs and addressed whatever the circumstances were that led to the behavior showing up again and things like that. There's no hard and fast time period of time that we make people stop. It's more they have to have demonstrated sufficiently that it's back under control to us. And just to say, too, we've only had, it's about 25% of our clients have relapsed into self-injury or suicidal behavior during the PTSD treatment. So it's not very many of them, and that rate is no higher than we find in DBT in general. After people have a couple months of abstinence, they're likely to have a relapse like that. But so we do have guidelines for when to stop and what to do when we're stopped and then when to resume again, which I don't have time to give you a lot of details on, but we have all that scoped out as well. So what I want to walk you through in our last couple of minutes here is some of the research findings so far. So we started this all with some pilot cases, and we did an open trial of 13 women with BPD and PTSD and suicide and self-injury. And that was done in 2012, it came out. And then we also have a pilot randomized controlled trial that came out pretty recently that compared DBT with and without this additional DBT-PE protocol. So I'll show you some of the results from this. You know, one of the main questions was about acceptability and feasibility. Will clients, do they want the treatment? Will they do the treatment? Is it okay? You know, are they satisfied with it? All that kind of stuff. Can we get them through it in a year? So that slide on treatment preferences, this is we asked our clients as they were entering into the study before they knew what kind of treatment they would be getting or anything to read a brief paragraph about what DBT is, a brief paragraph about what prolonged exposure is, and then to simply state which treatment they would prefer to get, one or the other in isolation or the two combined. And nearly, you know, over three-quarters of them, you know, walking in the door said they would want to have both treatments combined, which is great news for us and is part of why it makes it possible to then say things like, well, you have to stop self-injuring for at least 2 months or I won't do this treatment with you, and have that actually be something that's motivating because they actually really want this treatment. Well, they want to not have PTSD is what they want, understandably. Okay, so here's this crazy graph that says treatment feasibility, open trial, and pilot RCT at the top. I want to walk you through this because this is really answering the question of, you know, how were we able to roll this out with people? Were they able to get through it? So across the studies, we've had 30 people, 30 clients who were assigned to get DBT with the DBT prolonged exposure protocol. If we go down, we see that first box underneath is 12 people or 40% never started the PTSD part of the treatment. So they didn't start it at all. The reasons they didn't start it, the number one reason they didn't start it is because they dropped out of DBT. So the main barrier to getting people through PTSD treatment is getting them to stay in DBT. So the second reason, most common reason people didn't start the PTSD treatment was because their PTSD went away on its own. We didn't have that many of those, but three people where their PTSD kind of spontaneously remitted, and so they could have done the treatment, but they didn't need it by the time we got there. And then the least common reason people didn't start was the thing that we were all worried about, which was that we weren't able to get them stabilized enough to be eligible to meet those readiness criteria. And so far in our research, we've only had two people for whom that has been true, that we weren't able to get them stabilized. So that is not the reason people are not doing it. They're not doing it because they're dropping out of DBT is the number one thing. So then if we go up the other side, the orange boxes, if you have colors. So 60% of them at least started the PTSD treatment. On average, they started after 20 weeks of DBT, so about 5 months of DBT is what it's taking us to get them stabilized. that's the average. And then once they started, the completion rate of the DBT-PE protocol is 73%. So 73% go all the way through it and finish it, and that completion rate is the same as what you find in studies of prolonged exposure therapy in general. So our clients are completing at the same rates as anybody else. And then it's taking them an average of 13 sessions to get through it. And in those 13 sessions, we're targeting an average of between 2 and 3 trauma memories per person, because most of our folks, well, everybody actually, has multiple traumas, and so we do more than one as needed to get them through the treatment. So that's kind of how it has rolled out. So we have gotten most people through who stay in DBT, and then they complete it in the year. So treatment safety, just to quickly say, those I told you we're tracking their urges before and after every exposure task. So there's a table here of all the data we have so far from over 700 different exposure tasks with our clients. And the most common thing that happens is their urges don't change at all. So 78 to 80% of the time, there's no change. So they started a 1 out of 5 and they ended a 1 out of 5 after exposure. It has no impact. It's actually more common that their urges go down as a result of doing exposure immediately afterwards, and it's pretty uncommon that they go up. So less than 7 to 8% of the time do their urges actually go up. So we're feeling like we can reasonably say from an urges perspective that we are not making people worse by doing exposure. This next bar graph is from the open trial, where I just sort of put it together with the last big DBT randomized controlled trial, Marsha's study from 2006. If we just look over at the box on the far right, the treatment year total, you can see that the blue lines were from Marsha's prior DBT study, and the orange bars are from my open trial, that the rates of any suicide attempt during the treatment year or any non-suicidal self-injury was quite a bit lower than in that last big DBT study, which you can't directly compare. They were different studies, but at least after this initial open trial, we were feeling pretty good that we were not making them worse. And then the next slide is from our pilot RCT, where the punchline here is in that box, but essentially the people who got the additional DBT-PE protocol in that study were actually less likely to attempt suicide and less likely to self-injure than the clients who got DBT alone. And the most striking result there is on suicide attempts. So the people who got the PE, only 17% attempted suicide during the study compared to 40% of people who got DBT alone. Quite a difference there. So it actually looks like adding in the PTSD treatment is making these behaviors less likely to occur. Okay, and then quickly just looking at their PTSD, our outcomes here in terms of getting to the point of remission on PTSD, that first slide is looking at post-treatment. You'll see the blue bars are the completers. So across the three samples, we've had 67 to 80% of our people get to the point of full remission from PTSD who actually completed the DBT-PE protocol. And then if we look across the whole sample, it's a little bit lower, 57 to 60% got to remission of PTSD. That means it's including people who didn't actually do the PE treatment. Those rates are very comparable to what you find in exposure treatments more generally for PTSD. You see the box up on the top there, 68% of completers and 53% of the full sample is what you normally find. So they're getting to remission at the same rates as any other PTSD samples. And then if you look at the very last bar graph there for the pilot RCT, you'll see the two columns on the far right are for the people who just got DBT alone, where their rates of PTSD remission were 40% among treatment completers and 33% in the full sample. So we have doubled the rate of remission from PTSD by adding in the DBT-PE protocol from 40% in completers up to 80% in completers in that study. So it definitely is improving things in the way we would like. And then just to say quickly, that next slide is looking at 3 months follow-up after they got out of the study or out of the treatment, and we followed them up 3 months later. That circle on there from the pilot RCT is to show that 0% of the people that had received DBT were still in remission from PTSD 3 months later. So even though, you know, it was a second ago 40% got there at post-treatment, everybody relapsed by 3 months later. So the effects are going to be a lot less stable, it looks like, for the people who get DBT alone, whereas the remission rates stay quite high, 50 and 60% in the people who got the DBT-PE. So it makes their PTSD better, and then it maintains those after treatment. So the last thing I'm going to say, that final slide on secondary outcomes, and I have another circle on there, it's just the main finding I want to highlight. It's how many people got to the point of recovery, which is defined as a reliable reduction in a problem, as well as it then being within the range of normal functioning at the end of treatment, is how recovery is defined. And that global severity index, this is global functioning, so this is just across the board their level of functioning in terms of psychological distress in lots of different areas. The people who completed the DBT-PE in our study, 80% of them were recovered at the end of treatment, back in the range of normal functioning on a wide range of things compared to 0% in DBT. So it also really looks like treating their PTSD is really making a difference, not only in their PTSD, but in having an impact on a wide range of other problems that PTSD was likely exacerbating when it wasn't being, you know, when it was untreated. So so that's another good reason to try to integrate this in. So I'm aware of the time, and I'm going to stop talking. You can read through the conclusions and lots of acknowledgments of all the people who've helped me with this work, who I couldn't have done it without, and then some reading recommendations at the end. But I'm going to pause and see if there's any questions.
Thank you so much, Melanie. That was a really wonderful talk, and your findings are all very exciting, especially I actually got goosebumps when I heard you describe the recovery findings at the end. Really exciting work. So we did get a couple of questions in. The first one is, what if your self-injury is because of your symptoms from PTSD? So the essentially the self-harm is secondary to the PTSD symptoms. Does that influence your criteria or your protocol in any way?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times that is the case. I mean, a lot of our clients are, you know, using self-injury to cope with flashbacks or dissociation or intrusive memories from trauma and all that. So there's very often a link there. So this is, to some extent, a chicken and egg problem, but we have still held firm with, and you have to stop this. Like, you have to stop it. We'll give you skills. We'll help you learn other things you can do to manage your flashbacks, other things you can do to, you know, manage dissociation and prevent dissociation without having to self-injure. And we need you to stop doing that so that we can get in there and then treat this thing that is making you want to do it in the first place. But it's still, we got to get that window of time and get them some skills where they're able to do other things to manage the fact that they have PTSD. It's essentially, it's like we frame it up as like, there's going to be this period of time where you are going to have PTSD, and we have to teach you how to be a person who's living with PTSD effectively, so that we can then get in there and actually treat it so it will go away. But first we have to have that, able to have PTSD without resorting to doing all these other things.
That makes sense. The next question is, any research data on different symptoms and course of treatment connected with different trauma causes?
So most of our people had, well, on average, they had 12 different types of trauma in my samples that started on average before age 6 and continued throughout their lives. So they had scads of trauma. Most of them identified childhood sexual or physical abuse as their most distressing trauma. The only thing I can say about, and it's been equally as effective for any type of trauma we've tried to do it with, including, I should say, the trauma that wouldn't meet the DSM definition of trauma, so sort of traumatic invalidation, essentially, people who were severely verbally abused and just incredible invalidation growing up without any physical or sexual trauma necessarily, we also treat that invalidation kinds of trauma. So the only thing in terms of the actual question that I can say is those people who I referred to whose PTSD kind of spontaneously remitted without having to go through this real targeted treatment for it, those people were they all had adult trauma without childhood stuff. And it was often that they came into treatment while that adult trauma was still going on. They were in abusive relationships mostly, or had just barely gotten out. And so their PTSD was intense at the beginning of treatment, and then as we got them out of those relationships and into safer environments, their PTSD just kind of naturally went away without us targeting it. So that's the only real difference I can say is for those few people who may have just adult-only trauma, they may be the ones who actually don't need the full targeted treatment, but some of them will still too. So,
and actually, a follow-up question I have to that is: would you recommend these same principles for people who have, sub-threshold PTSD or don't meet the full criteria for PTSD, but are still struggling with post-traumatic symptoms?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, if they have significant post-traumatic symptoms that are impairing in some way and that they would like to treat, then sure, we would do it this way, and I have the same criteria for starting and all.
Okay.
That.
Next question is, any rationale for why you chose PE, prolonged exposure, as opposed to a less exposure-heavy PTSD treatment such as cognitive processing therapy?
Yeah. The rationale for that was that the DBT text says to use exposure. DBT is primarily a behavioral treatment as opposed to cognitive. It's less emphasized. So it fits better sort of within DBT and within what the manual did say about it. That's the main reason. I have no data to support this whatsoever, other than one clinical situation. But I also personally have had the experience of cognitive strategies not working as well with our clients, only because their beliefs are often quite rigid and sort of trying to do standard cognitive, modification things, at least for me, doesn't get me very far a fair amount of the time. So I've also found sort of the exposure and behavioral kinds of things tend to work better with our clients, even if they have super rigid beliefs.
Great. And last question I actually want to ask you is, this is my question, for people out there living with PTSD and BPD, given that, you're still in the stages of conducting this research, for people who might come to you and say, I want to treat my PTSD, but my therapist hasn't been trained in your protocol yet. Any advice, resources, suggestions you would have for those individuals?
Certainly. I would say get trained in the protocol. No, that's one thing. I do workshops through behavioral tech on the 2-day workshop, but the next one's actually in June in Wisconsin. I would love to have people there who might be interested in learning it. But that's kind of the main way to go. Otherwise, I think I'd have to, on a case-by-case basis, see if they can figure out a solution with their therapist about what to do if there's somebody in the area who could do, you know, pair up in some way with their, I don't know. Anyway, I'd have to think that through.
Wonderful. So we're at 9 o'clock. I want to remind people, as Melanie said, that the last, I think it's 3 or so slides on the handout do have recommendations for further reading. So thank you again, Melanie, for this wonderful talk and sharing your exciting findings. And to everyone on the call, hope that you'll join us for our next call-in on June 1st. With Jill Rafis, who will be presenting her work on adapting DBT for adolescents with emotion dysregulation. So we will sign off now, and thanks again, Melanie.
Yeah, thank you, everybody.
Okay, bye-bye.